Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Linzag, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Today's episode is part of the special Election 2020 series on the President's Inbox. Each week between now and the Iowa caucuses in February, I am sitting down with two experts with different views on how the United States should deal with the foreign policy challenges it faces. We hope that the contending perspectives will give you a fuller understanding of what the candidates are and aren't saying on the campaign trail. This week's topic is Russia. Joining me to discuss U.S. policy toward Russia are Rajan Menon and Ambassador Stephen Sestanovich. Rajan is the Anne and Bernard Spitzer Professor of International Relations at the Powell School at the City College of New York and Senior Research Scholar at the Saltzman Institute of War and Peace Studies at Columbia University. Raj, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you, Jim.
Steve is the George F. Kennan Senior Fellow for Russian and Eurasian Studies at CFR and a Professor of International Diplomacy at Columbia University. From 1997 to 2001, he was the U.S. Ambassador at Large for the former Soviet states. Thanks for joining me today, Steve.
As always, a pleasure, Jim.
Where I'd like to begin the discussion is with current U.S. policy. And Raj, maybe we'll start with you, but as I sort of look at U.S. policy, two things stand out to me. On the one hand, you have a policy that emphasizes Russia as a strategic competitor, talks about great power competition, and we have a range of sanctions that have been imposed by the United States on Russia over Crimea, sponsorship of Ukrainian separatists, interference in the 2016 U.S. presidential election. On the other hand, we have President Trump, who himself has talked quite positively about Russian President Vladimir Putin and dismissed the conclusion of the U.S. intelligence community about Russian interference in the 2016 election. So as you look at current U.S. policy, how do you make sense of it?
As to President Trump's attitude toward Mr. Putin and Russia in general, I must say I'm mystified. I don't quite understand it. As you know, there are varying theories. He's drawn to strong leaders, Putin, Kim Jong-il, and others. He's partly also, I think, reacting to things Russian as part of the effort to deflect the criticism that he partly owes his office to Russia. Some of his policies, I think, come from an instinctive desire to disengage and realize that other countries will fill the vacuum, which he doesn't seem to care very much about. I'm not saying that that's a good thing or a bad thing, but that seems to be his view.
And how do you compare that with what is official U.S. policy, which is this notion that we have now entered this era of great power competition and that Russia is one of the two main strategic competitors the United States faces?
Correct. I think Trump would buy the proposition that we have entered the era of great power competition, but as best I can make out, he's much more focused on China. But to the beginning of your question, I think that it's a radical break from the Republican and Democratic consensus, which is to say that commitments to NATO ought to be kept, that Ukraine ought to be supported, if necessary, by military means, that is, through American weaponry, that Russia poses a clear and present danger to the equilibrium in Europe and to American values. And I would say it's a fairly hawkish view. Trump's is definitely a departure from that. And to that extent, the Russians prefer him to be in office rather than any of his competitors.
So, Steve, how would you assess current U.S. policy?
I think Raj captures it exactly right. But let's add a couple of things, because you've had developments here which have kept the administration from having a particularly coherent approach that the Russians themselves can understand. The Congress, wary of Trump's views of Putin, forced a lot of new sanctions on him. His own executive departments, the Pentagon, State Department, CIA, all agree in a policy that you could call something like neo-containment. And so they have pushed for more support, just as Raj says, for Ukraine, more skeptical view of arms control agreements, a kind of minimal cooperation in Syria. You know, the difficulty of capturing the whole thing is great enough for us. But for the Russians, to try to figure out what's going on has been especially difficult. And they've retreated to a view which I think it lets themselves off the hook. That is, they say, this is all crazy American domestic politics. We don't have to think about it very hard. We don't have to weigh what the problems are that have developed in Russian-American relations because of our own policy. And so I think you have a kind of freezing of the account and of the thinking that the Russians might otherwise be doing.
Rush, I want to get back to this idea that Steve touched on about neo-containment, obviously containment being the policy of the United States toward the Soviet Union during the Cold War. Do you think it makes sense for the United States to view Russia as a strategic competitor?
Yes and no. In some respects, Steve touched on Ukraine, Syria, and other places. There is no question that the policies of the United States and Russia are at the very least misaligned. I could add Turkey to the mix. But I would say that there are some areas where, out of sheer self-interest, we may have to work with Russia. So let's go back to Ukraine. On balance, the bogus referendum that detached Crimea from Ukraine and the instigation of a separatist movement in Ukraine, that cannot be accepted as okay. On the other hand, I think that there can be no solution to the Ukraine problem that lasts without bringing Russia into it. The thing to figure out is what the Russians are willing to do to balance their relationship with the West. Because my own reading is, although they whistle past the graveyard when it comes to China and their so-called strategic partnership with China, which has been going on, by the way, since 1992, they're rather uncomfortable with it. And they're hoping that over time, fissures will arise in the Euro-Atlantic alliance. They're waiting it out. But I would say on balance, I think they are struck by the fact that it's all held together rather well. And they're not quite sure how long this will last. They will tell you that the sanctions are not hurting, but Steve and I were just back from Russia, and if you talk to knowledgeable Russians on the side, they will tell you the sanctions absolutely are hurting them.
What about you, Steve? What is sort of your position on this idea of a policy of neo-containment? Does it make sense?
Well, I think we should remember that containment allowed for a lot of outreach to the Soviet Union and certain kinds of narrow agreements that were intended to stabilize the relationship. The detente period was maybe the supreme example of that, but by no means.
This was the 1970s, Richard Nixon, Henry Kissinger.
The first arms control agreements. And I think it's important to bear in mind that when we look at people who are very tough on the Russians, and you hear a lot of that in the Congress, those are still people who would favor renewing arms control agreements that the Trump administration has been lukewarm about or even pulled out of. I think you'd find the same view at the Pentagon and at the State Department. They want to be tougher on the Russians than the president does, but they want to have some stabilization agreements that the president has been willing to sacrifice. So the question for anybody putting together a Russia policy is, how do you mix and match those different elements?
Okay, so the devil's in the details, so to speak. Right. The issue really is how you balance and where you balance competition and cooperation.
I add one thing? So I think it is correct that in the 70s, although we had containment in place, Nixon and Kissinger and Newt Ford had maneuvering room to do a great deal, and we all know what those things were. I would liken this period more to the early 80s, the Afghan invasion, the INF deployments, and so on. I think that for whatever complicated set of reasons, the attitude and the discourse toward Russia has become so poisonous that elected officials, not the people in the Pentagon or the CIA, who I agree with Steve, are loath to be seen as people who in any shape, way, or form want to articulate a policy of cooperation with Russia at the moment, even based on self-interest, which is why when you look at the Democratic candidates, there's not a lot of daylight between them. There's not a lot of daylight between them and what you refer to as the neo-containment policy, at least as far as I can make out.
I want to come back to that point, but first, let's sort of explore a little bit about how the world looks from Moscow, from the Kremlin. Mm-hmm. And I guess my first question, I'll give it to you, Raj, which is really this question of what is it that Vladimir Putin wants? Does he have a strategic vision? Sometimes I hear people talking to me as a grand plan of splitting NATO, dividing Europe. And other times I hear him described by experts as somebody who's basically great at tactics. He's responding to events in the moment, but doesn't necessarily have a grand plan. Where do you fall on that score?
There's a long tradition in the history of international politics for academics and policymakers to see one side as inept and bumbling and the other side as a master strategist. I've never looked at Mr. Putin as a master strategist. I think, however, his worldview has been shaped by three things. One, his career in what is now the FSB, what was then the KGB, which instills in you two things: the desire to keep the country together and the belief that that entails a very healthy wariness toward a whole panoply of external enemies. He brings that conspiratorial mindset to bear. The second is the collapse of the Russian economy and the Russian military in the 1990s, which he saw as Russia brought to his knees. And I think in his own mind, he believes that although Russians have a share of the blame to bear, that this was done as part of a desire to check Russia on the part of the West. I'm not saying that that's true, but I think he believes it. So when he came to power in 2000, with a kind of deal with Yeltsin to begin with, he saw himself as in the tradition of the great Russian restorers, almost kind of a latter-day Peter the Great. His idea was to make the state strong again. So he had this term, which translates badly into English, called the vertical of power, centralizing the state, building up the military. That was possible in the early 2000s because oil prices were very high. He's run out of that. So what does Vladimir Putin want? Vladimir Putin is a Russian nationalist who believes that Russia ought to be restored to great power status and that in certain areas, it has an overriding right to arrange the political and military and social balance of forces, particularly in what used to be called the near abroad.
Can I draw you out on that? Yeah. Because you've written a lot about this, and on my blog I will list things that you and Steve have both written on this. People want to access it. But there is this question about, and I often hear it, that Putin has great power aspirations. Mm-hmm. But I'm not really sure what that means specifically in terms of what is it that he wants, or is what he wants in some sense variable depending upon what he thinks he can get?
Yes. So there's a symbolic aspect. I think getting kicked out of the G8 was, despite the bravado of Mr. Putin, a serious blow. He likes to play with the big boys and girls.
He wants status.
And to project himself on the global stage. Like most politicians, he's a very vain man and likes to be at the center of attention. So the pomp and ceremony thing is there. He wants to revert to a saying attributed to one-time Soviet Foreign Minister Andrei Gromyko, that no major issue in world politics can be settled without Russian participation. Gromyko said that of the Soviet Union. But I think he is a person with a healthy skepticism of the limitations of Russian power, about which, if you'll allow me later, I'd like to say something, and realizes that he cannot pretend, even potentially, to the kind of sweep of ambition that the United States will have for many decades to come, and China is fast acquiring. So I would say there are certain areas where he's very, very sensitive, and that is in the areas abutting Russia. And there, through various instruments and with the great advantage of geography, he's able to do a great deal, even if in some respects he holds a weak hand.
Steve, let me draw you out on this. What is your view of Vladimir Putin? Does he have a grand plan that he is systematically implementing, or is he somebody who's making it up as he goes along?
Well, he makes up individual moves as he goes along, and often they're designed to cover up mistakes that he has made. But I think we have to acknowledge that in many ways, Putin can point to a significant increase in Russia's power and status in the time that he has been in office. His benchmark, and he thinks it's the main benchmark that Russians throughout the country use in evaluating their situation, is the 1990s, which was a time of economic distress, a downsizing of Russian foreign policy, and a kind of loss of morale, which he feels he has done a lot to correct. The economy is multiple times bigger than it was in the 90s. GDP has gone up 4 or 5 times in a stretch of time. He can say that in certain areas he has built Russia up. The military budget is more than 100% what it was a decade ago. In the Middle East, there's been an extraordinary show of Russian power of a kind that the Soviets themselves rarely indulged in. And it's now kind of commonplace among commentators to say that Russia is the country that everybody in the Middle East has to talk to in order to figure out their own moves. So he's got a kind of on a roll story to tell, which is not to be dismissed. The other side of it, of course, what I call the on the ropes story is that the economy has been stagnating for more than half a decade. There's an increase, resulting increase in political opposition. For all that Putin is very interested in building a kind of buffer zone on the Russian periphery, particularly of states that were in the former Soviet Union, actually, they're not very good at it, and they've encountered a lot of reverses and have discovered that actually most countries on their periphery don't want to be super influenced.
Surprise, by Russia.
And they've had a radical downturn in relations with the United States. And that's the other way that the Russians measure themselves. You know, the glory days of the Cold War were ones in which there was bipolarity, and the Soviet Union and the United States decided many things. That's their popular memory.
It was a G2 before we started talking
about
it.
And they don't have that kind of partnership anymore. They can't count on it, and they have absorbed a lot of setbacks as a result of that. The United States and Europe have, as we've said, imposed a huge raft of sanctions on them. So they're both feeling more powerful and more isolated.
Okay. May I offer a compliment very briefly and
certainly
a friendly
Raj.
Amendment? So the compliment is this. I think what's remarkable about Mr. Putin is not the restoration of Russia as a great power globally, which manifestly he has not done, but it has been to raise Russia's stature and capacities in the way that Steve mentioned, while holding remarkably a weak hand. So just some numbers for perspective. Russia's GDP, about 1.2 trillion, is about the size of the Benelux countries.
Belgium, Netherlands, and Luxembourg.
Correct. It's sort of between Spain and South Korea. Now, this is a country of 145 million people. Its defense budget, depending on what source you look at and how what they're doing, PPP or exchange rates, between 40 and 60 million. The United States has a defense budget of 700 billion. Now, we have a much greater global ambit, but even given that, the Chinese have a defense budget four times that of Russia. India has a defense budget larger. They are facing a demographic catastrophe. The projections are by the Russian Academy of Sciences that Russian population will shrink by 20%. Already in one-third of Russia's provinces, the mortality rate is growing very, very significantly. One final thing. This still remains a petro-economy. 48% of the budget comes from energy, and about 65% of exports come from energy, the rest from diamonds and gold and arms. There has been no diversification of the Russian economy to make it a peer competitor of the frontline states in the globalized world. That said, if you look at Syria, the relationship with Israel, the relationship with Turkey, the relationship with the UAE, the relationship with China, with all the risks, he's done tolerably well if you're a poker player.
Played a weak hand well.
That's right.
Maximized his card, so
Correct.
To speak. Let me ask just one quick question, because we've been talking about what Mr. Putin wants, but I guess that presumes we think Mr. Putin is going to continue to matter. So let me put that question, maybe begin with you, Raj. Is Mr. Putin sort of secure in the United States, whoever becomes president in 2020, 2021? Should they focus on Mr. Putin, or is Mr. Putin's hold on power shaky and tenuous?
There are signs of increasing discontent in large metropolitan areas. The regime has been able to contain it through an artful mix of force and ventilation. By ventilation, I mean Russia is a far cry from North Korea or even China. So people will talk on the streets about the shortcomings of life in Russia and the regime. Russian academics, depending on who you talk to, generally will. The bookstores, both in English and Russian, contain a panoply of literature of all sorts, many of it critical of Mr. Putin. Radio reasonably free. The one red line is if you're an opponent and go on television and bash the regime, you're in serious trouble, because that simply carries more valence for the average Russian than it does. Now, so there's no danger, I think, of an imminent collapse, although stranger things have happened, as we know. I think that there will be found some artful constitutional way to keep him in power. There are various theories of how it might happen.
His term runs through what, 2024?
2024. Yeah. One is that there will be a federation of Russia and Belarus, and so there will be a new entity, and Putin will be president. That assumes that Mr. Lukashenko wants, the president of Belarus, wants to play second fiddle to Putin, and that's not at all clear. But if you want to find a way, they'll find a way. I don't think the long knives are out in the power corridors of Russia to turn against him. So I don't think he's in any imminent danger. I suspect we'll be dealing with him for quite some time.
Okay, so you agree, Steve, we're not simply going to be able to wait out Mr. Putin?
Well, I think that Russians are obsessed now with this very question, and it colors everything that they think about, because they don't know how this figure, who has been so important for 20 years, is going to leave the stage or whether. And that means a lot of people whose well-being and livelihood have depended on a certain kind of stability are asking themselves, do I need to make new arrangements? Raj is absolutely right that the long knives are not out, but people are very much thinking about what kinds of consequences might follow from different sorts of departures by Putin. And that means, you know, are there going to be new political parties? Interestingly, Russian politicians don't want to run with Putin's party anymore because it's so unpopular.
This is United Russia?
Yes. And that's an interesting indicator. Putin has not created a kind of legitimacy or popularity for the regime as a whole. His personal popularity is high. So people are asking, what will be the form of politics when he's gone? You can't visit Moscow without having that conversation, although the truth is nobody knows the answer, and that increases their anxiety. Most Western commentators, when they think about this question, are equally paralyzed, but they often say, well, this means we should have a kind of outreach to the Russian people in some way, cultural exchanges and the like. I think that's absolutely right, but the question really is, what are we going to say? And here I think Americans and Europeans don't have a particularly good answer about the kind of relationship we want in the future with Russia or what we envision of Russia itself in the future.
The reason that the Russians are obsessed in the way that Steve mentions, and that's correct, is this is a system that, to fall back on some jargon just for a second, is over-personalized and under-institutionalized. There are these institutions. There is United Russia. But Mr. Putin is a singularly dominant figure. So the question is, you know, what comes after him is always speculation, especially because the march of time is relentless. He's still a relatively young man, but he's no longer the really young man who took over some 20 years ago. And Russian males don't have a very high life expectancy. I mean, Mr. Putin's physically fit and mentally acute, but the post-Putin speculation will increase there, and it'll be carried over here. But I would say whoever the next president is will deal with Mr. Putin. I don't see this as a regime in trouble. I see it in long term as a country with serious problems that won't be able to fulfill the ambitions of Mr. Putin.
I disagree a little bit about under-institutionalized, because what Putin has done is create stability by re-energizing the state bureaucracy, by bringing more of the economy under state control. You know, it's more than doubled. The percentage of the state economy is now 70% of the total economy that is now controlled by the state. And those institutions are going to play a role. We don't know the process by which they're going to play this role, but the military intelligence complex in Russia is a real thing. It is going to be a powerful force in the Putin succession. Not the only one, not necessarily able to dictate, but that's a significant part of the Russia that we're dealing with, is one that has been given a particular institutional shape by Putin.
We spent a lot of time talking about diagnosis. I want to talk about prescription. I want to go through a number of issues that are in the U.S.-Russian relationship, points of contention. I take Steve's point that the United States and the West don't have a broader message for Russia. Maybe it's worth developing one. If you have ideas on that score, I want to hear them. But obviously, when you're making policy, you tend to focus on individual policies rather than perhaps their sum total. So let's work through some of the specifics. Let's talk about Ukraine. What should the United States be doing about Ukraine? Maybe with you, Raj.
It's a very hard nut to crack. I agree with the proposition that the Ukrainians have the right of self-determination and the right to have a country that's sovereign and free from aggression. And to that extent, we have an interest both normatively and practically in the success of Ukraine. But principle and norms and commitments, actual or potential, always exist within a particular strategic situation. And the strategic reality is that the status of Ukraine, whether it joins NATO, however far-fetched it may seem now, whether it drifts westward, is something for which I think this government, as witness the fact that it's suffered through the sanctions for quite a long time, is prepared to slit a lot of veins. I think much more than us. So there's an asymmetry, I think, of interest and an asymmetry of capability. They can simply do a lot more because of geography.
Well, let me sharpen the question. Yeah. Would you, for example, endorse providing lethal military aid to Ukraine? Would you step back and suggest that the United States take off the table the possibility of Ukraine becoming a member of NATO, or encouraging the European Union not to have Ukraine as a member of the EU?
So I'm on public record on a couple of these things, and my position is a minority position. I did not favor and do not favor arming Ukraine. Now, why not? It's not because I don't want Ukraine to be able to defend itself. But in strategy, you have to ask the question, if you take the first step, what will the second step be? So once you arm the Ukrainian military, you have, whether you like it or not, made an ersatz commitment. The United States has made an ersatz commitment. And withdrawing from that commitment is very hard, because there will be the chorus of credibility people who will say, we can't withdraw from anywhere because it...
Well, we see this in the debate over the Middle East.
Correct. Now, assume a situation where the political settlement that's in the making, and I'm not hopeful, in Donbass, eastern Ukraine, falls apart. And the war begins again. And we have something like the Battle of Debaltseve in 2014, where the Ukrainian army faced significant retreat. Well, what is our situation when we have begun to arm the Ukrainians and made a defense commitment? I would submit to you that if you want to have a military confrontation with Russia, which I don't think we should have under except extreme circumstances, the Russian border is probably the worst place to have that confrontation. As for NATO...
Because the stakes are clearly very high for Russia?
Well, I think that they can do a lot more and are prepared to do a lot more than we will. And I rather... despair of airy commitments based on norms that are given to countries that are far away and that we can't keep them. I think we undermine our standing as a major power by doing that. And I don't think that there will be much public support for getting into a dust-up with Russia over Ukraine. One final thing, Jim. There's a little bit of a misapprehension about Ukraine. Ukraine is a leading exporter of arms. It has, in the form of the Stugna ATM, anti-tank missile, a fairly robust anti-tank system. So the Javelins add something, but this is not a country that has...
Javelins being the materiel the United States has promised.
Correct. And under strict conditions, by the way. So that is the reason why I don't favor it. As for NATO, you asked, I think that question is off the table for the moment, in the sense that I am not entirely sure about the degree of enthusiasm shared by the Europeans for integrating NATO, let alone Georgia, into Ukraine. So that's almost kind of a moot point.
Georgia, just because Georgia the country, not Georgia the state of
correct,
the United States.
Correct, so. Correct. Georgia the state is safe as far as we know.
Okay. So Steve, what is your sense of what U.S. policy should be dealing with Ukraine?
The Obama administration was quite divided on this issue, and they hesitated, held back from providing lethal assistance because they were worried about provoking hostilities that the Ukrainians would not be able to manage. Here, I think the passage of time and the policy of the Trump administration, goaded by Congress and the Pentagon and defense industry, has actually been positive. The Ukrainian military is more capable than it used to be, and the best way to prevent the kind of unstable confrontation that Raj describes is for the Ukrainians to be able to defend themselves, and they're in much better position to do that, and with further assistance will be in
better... So you support the provision of lethal military aid to the Ukrainians?
Yeah, and really there's very little opposition now to that issue. It's one on which the sides have kind of hardened and the preponderance of opinion is in favor. Raj raises a broader question, which is how to think about Ukraine's relationship to NATO. And that has been discussed in a very unhelpful way, I would say, over the past decade and more, with the NATO alliance actually saying in 2008 that Ukraine would become a member. There are others who say we should have an agreement with the Russians that Ukraine will never become a member. My own view is that we have been insensitive to the impact of such decisions on Ukrainians and on the stability of Ukraine, which is in our interest. So that saying Ukraine will be in NATO not only drives the Russians crazy, but it drives a lot of Ukrainians crazy. And it has increased division within the country. Saying that it will never be in NATO has the same effect. It drives people in Ukraine against each other. Really, what's in our interest is for Ukraine to be able to defend itself, stable, more able over time to work this issue out by itself. With warm encouragement and the supply of arms and so forth from Western governments, but without lines being drawn one place or another, that is something that will be hard for the Russians to live with, because they'd rather have a firm agreement that there will never be NATO membership. I think that isn't the kind of policy that any American administration after 2020 is likely to follow. We're likely to have one which I think will do the right thing, will try to make stability in Ukraine a goal and let them sort it out for themselves.
Let me switch topics now. Let's talk about arms control.
Sure.
I'm going to go to you, Steve, first. As you know, the Trump administration has accelerated a trend that predated it of getting out of a variety of arms control agreements. Most notably, it has left the Intermediate Nuclear Forces, or INF, treaty, and is talking about getting out of something known as the Open Skies Agreement, which allows overflight on other countries' soil. Where do you come down on how the next president, what you would like to see the next president do on the arms control front? Are we right to leave these agreements, or should we be trying to sort of keep the arms control architecture of the 1970s and 80s alive?
I think the arms control architecture of the 1970s and 80s was pretty advantageous for the United States, and especially the architecture of the late 80s, when Reagan and Gorbachev and then Bush and Gorbachev worked out a number of agreements. 30 years have passed, and there have been changes. The likelihood, I would say, for a new administration is the first issue they'll have to face is, do they want to extend what is arguably the most important of all these treaties, and that's the New START Treaty, which was negotiated by President Obama 2010, 2011. And that can be extended for 5 years by mutual agreement. No action of Congress is necessary. It's the simplest thing in the world. And it is likely to recommend itself.
And the deadline for doing that, I believe, is early February 2021.
It can be handled by a new president. He'll have a few days. The Russians have now been making this one of their main desiderata. Putin and the foreign minister have said, this is what we want to stabilize the relationship. My guess is a new president is likely to buy that one. What he's going to do more broadly about the whole set of arms control agreements, it's a tougher question, because technology has changed, other powers have become more important, the role of China is going to be factored into this. That will involve the kind of careful bureaucratic studies that new administrations do. And the president's eyes will glaze over with all those reports. The bureaucrats will have to sort it out. But the thing he can decide the day he takes office in January 2021 is to extend New START. And my prediction is he or she will do it.
Raj, what is your take on arms control?
I agree with that. But if you'll permit me just a very brief coda on Ukraine. I think it's a mistake, as Steve pointed out, to say that Ukraine will be in NATO or won't be in NATO, because no one is pressing for an answer to that question. I think it would be reckless to do that. I support giving Ukraine a large panoply of things to make it stronger. I do believe that it should be made stronger. My point is that we have to make very clear that if we make certain commitments, we've thought about the follow-on consequences and are prepared to own those consequences. Now, on arms control, I mean, I largely agree with Steve. So the INF treaty has liquidated itself. The New START treaty is not self-liquidating, because it can be extended. The worst-case scenario for us is to have neither INF nor New START, not unlikely in the latter case for the reasons that Steve mentioned, in a situation of rising tensions where the two sides are introducing into their arsenals a new class of weapons that really changes the dynamic. I have in mind hypersonic weapons, something I've been working on lately. So I think the arms control regime is something that is in our mutual interest. We're not doing the Russians any favors. They are harping on it for, I think, a somewhat different reason. They want to find some issue on which they can say to the United States, there are things that we can work on, and hope to use that as a wedge for broadening cooperation. Whether that'll work or not is a different
thing. What do you think those things might be, Raj?
Well, arms control is one of them. And I think there's a debate about exactly why the INF treaty fell apart. They would rather have had a discussion about, was there a way to resolve the differences over this errant missile? And my own view is that had we found out that there was no way, that they were prepared to let the INF treaty die rather than yield on this missile, we might have wanted to walk away. But we didn't really do that. The other area in which I think there's a mutual interest is there are parts of the world, Syria, the Baltics, the Black Sea, where our troops and armaments, planes and ships, are coming into dangerous contact with the Russians. Now, I'm not talking about a World War I scenario where one shot is fired and it cascades into a war, but this is a very, very dangerous thing. And so arrangements that reduce the possibility of that happening. In Syria, many people may not know this, but there have been encounters between American troops and Russian contract fighters in which some number of them have been killed. This has all been kept.
Russian contractors have been
killed. Correct. And it's not surprising because they're engaging in close proximity war. On the air, they're deconflicting agreements so that aircraft don't get shot down and so on. So I worry that some incident that neither side wants to have happen happens and could further poison the relationship and possibly escalate not into a war, but something that would be much more difficult to control.
Rosh, you introduced the Middle East, and I do want to talk about that because obviously Russia over the last 4 or 5 years has reinserted itself into the Middle East. There's a lot of talk about the post-America Middle East. Obviously, with President Trump announcing that he was withdrawing U.S. support for Syrian Kurds, that led to Turkey's invasion or incursion into northeastern Syria, and a lot of talk about how Russia had won in the Middle East. Maybe sort of from your point of view, are Russian gains in the Middle East an issue that Washington should be worried about? Or is this something that, from your point of view, the United States should encourage in some way?
If I might, let me just try to narrow your question by focusing on Syria for a moment.
Okay.
There's a little bit of solipsism or Middle Kingdom syndrome going on in this country about Syria. So to begin with, the criticism that it was President Obama's fecklessness that led the Russians to project forces into Syria. Now, we're a young country and may, in some respects, lack historical perspective, but let us not forget that the Russians concluded their first arms deal in the Middle East, not with Egypt, as most people think, but with Syria, in about 1953, 1954. They have had a relationship with the Ba'athist regime under Assad, the older Hafez al-Assad, and now Bashar, for a very long time. Syria is on their southern frontier. And so it had nothing to do with their perception of us or President Obama. Their view of Syria was that the alternative to Assad was either chaos or a takeover by radical Islamists, which whom, by the way, some of our friends and allies started on.
I take that point. I guess my question is, in terms of policymaking from Washington, is this a problem that needs to be confronted? And if so, how would you do it?
Well, the question is, you know, how do you confront it? You can't erase what gains the Russians and the Syrians have made in the Syrian government has made in Syria without putting a lot of troops on the ground and blood and treasure. And I don't see anyone doing that. I think you can have a more artful policy in the Middle East that tries to balance the extent to which the Russians have played the game of widening their presence more effectively. And our diplomacy under this president has, you know, frankly, been terrible at doing that.
Steve, you want to get in here?
Jim, you're absolutely right that there hasn't been much discussion about whether it really matters to the United States that Russian influence is greater. And I think the reason for this is we're quite confused about what our own stakes in the Middle East are these days. And the confusion is very broad. Does it matter that the Russians and the Saudis are conspiring to fix oil prices? Does it matter that the Russians are going to be shipping more arms to Egypt? That's a big question that has to be addressed, first of all, by deciding what American interests are, and then a lot will flow from that. But I would point out something that I think has to be part of that discussion, which hasn't been much focused on yet, and that is the Russian business model, you could call it, for gaining influence has turned out to be becoming the protector of last resort of regimes that have lost their legitimacy. And no matter the violence or the humanitarian consequences of this,
they're not advancing universal human rights.
That is for sure. And that's been the real commitment that the Russians made in Syria is we are going to make sure that the Assad regime does not go down. And What's interesting to me is you see some echoes of that in other policies. They've signed on to be Maduro's best
president of last resort.
They signed on to become big supporters of the Bashir regime in Sudan. They've now got a program of increasing arms sales and security assistance across Africa, including a very active role in the Libyan civil war. So I think one thing we have to be expecting is that Russian activity across the greater Middle East, and as the Venezuelan case shows, beyond it, is going to be based on this model. You know, I like to say, in the Cold War, we were worried about the Soviets bringing down precarious regimes. Now their model seems to be propping up precarious regimes, no matter the consequences. Okay. We're going to have to find a way to adjust to that and figure out what our own approach is going to be.
Well, presumably also figure out which of those countries matter to U.S.
Absolutely.
Interests.
Jim,
and whether
say,
we have the levers by which to influence
can
policy.
Can I say one thing here? So the narrative now in the wake of Mr. Trump's withdrawal from Syria has been the Russians have now been handed a great victory across the Middle East, and our credibility is folded. You know, I frankly don't buy this argument. So let's just go from the west of the Persian Gulf eastward. They have done some deals with the Saudis, but there is no question in whose camp, so to speak, the Saudis are. Ditto for
you. You haven't talked to the U.S. Congress recently.
Ditto the UAE. But there's no, the Saudis understand very well which side their bread is buttered on, so to speak, strategically speaking. Russia has made some inroads into Egypt and made itself relevant. Is Abdel Fattah al-Sisi crazy enough to believe that the United States can be traded away for Russia? I don't think so. Certainly not Israel, although there's a substantive relationship with Israel that the Russians have built up. But this has been going on.
So you're saying we have more leverage than we may think?
Absolutely. I don't think we've been driven. There's a lot of chest beating and heavy breathing about how we've almost been driven out of the Middle East. And I find that to be just not very helpful and not a very intelligent way to think about this.
I want to ask one last question, given our time constraints, and that has to do with Russian interference in the election. It happened in 2016, and basically, for everything we can tell, it is going up, and it's actually happening again and likely to continue through the election of 2020. What does the United States do about it, and to what extent should we condition U.S. policy toward the Kremlin on whether the Kremlin is, in essence, interfering? Steve, maybe you want to go first?
Well, I think most of the measures that are part of, you know, any candidates or prospective presidents' package of talking points here, they focus on unilateral actions that the United States has to do, harden its systems, make it harder for vote tampering to take place, make it easier to identify activity by Russian trolls and so forth. There are also opportunities to talk to the Russians about this, but it's very hard for the intelligence services of countries to talk to each other. Given the level of suspicion, it's very, very hard to actually have a meaningful conversation on this subject. And I don't think that is going to have much effect on what the Russians do in the next year and more leading up to the election. But it is true that what they do on their own will have potentially considerable effect on the way we see the Russians. It certainly has since 2016. My guess is we're talking in the end mostly about unilateral actions.
Raj?
The Russian interference in our democratic process, whether it's high or low, is something that no American president can tolerate or should tolerate. I think most Americans would agree with that. So I have a very firm position on that. That said, we have some vulnerabilities. We are a much more porous society by virtue of being a democracy, and we don't want to stop being a democracy. There are ways that you can monkey around in our politics that are open to countries that wouldn't be able to do that in more closed systems. There are multiple opportunities created by the revolution in social media and cyber warfare and all of this. So we're going to have to face this problem, but the Russians are going to have to face a problem. Americans, I think, if they understand that Russia is trying to subvert the electoral process, will not be happy. And if they're looking for some kind of rapprochement to balance between us and China, to be in the ranks of Western powers once again, This is a losing game, it seems to me, because they can only do so much without really demolishing the relationship if they keep this up. And I will say that in some respects, though, I'm more worried about what we're doing to ourselves on the Democratic front than what the Russians are doing, but that's a separate story.
On that note, I'll close up this special election 2020 episode of the President's Inbox for this week. My guests have been Rajan Menon, a professor of international relations at the Powell School at the City College of New York, and senior research scholar at the Saltzman Institute of War and Peace Studies at Columbia University, and Ambassador Stephen Sestanovich, a senior fellow of Russian Eurasian Studies here at CFR. Raj, Steve, thank you for joining me for today's conversation.
Thank you, Jim.
Been a pleasure. Thank you, Jim.
I have posted links to what Raj, Steve, and others have written about Russia on my blog, The Water's Edge. You can find the blog at cfr.org. Again, that's The Water's Edge on cfr.org. If you are not already subscribing to The President's Inbox, I hope you would consider doing so. You can subscribe to it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Whichever podcast service you use, I also hope that you would consider leaving us a review, as well as your suggestions for what topics to cover and which guests to invite. Your feedback helps us improve the show. As always, opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlich. Nick Sanders was our recording engineer. Special thanks to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This episode of the President's Inbox was made possible in part by a grant from the Carnegie Corporation of New York. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.